Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is Senior Vice President and Clinical Director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dan Hawkins, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at the National Association of Community Health Centers. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at the use of tiny robotics in biomedical research. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Traumatic brain injuries are suffered by an estimated 3 million athletes a year and at least 20% of active duty soldiers, leading to effects that can linger for a lifetime. These traumatic brain injuries occur even when soldiers and athletes are wearing helmets, and a team of scientists is pretty close to figuring out how and why. A research team from Sandia National Laboratories and the University of New Mexico have been on a four-year mission to map and catalog the brain's precise response to blast waves from explosives, as well as blows to the head, using a supercomputer and a 3D model of an actual head, in the hopes of providing the most comprehensive data to designers who might then be able to build a better helmet. Neurologist Dr. Corey Ford says, it's not the kind of research you could perform on living subjects.
The problem is, how are you going to study something like this? It's not something that you can use human subjects for, and we were not interested in animal models of traumatic brain injury. So we settled on using a high-speed supercomputer to model this process so that we could learn something about the physics of blast waves and how they interact with the human head in a virtual model.
First, he said, they had to catalog the property of all the elements of the brain, skull, spinal column, gray matter, fluids. Then they registered the effects of simulated blasts on each of these elements to determine just what happens to the brain during an explosion or on impact.
So the shockwave hits the subject from whatever direction, and energy is transferred through the scalp and skull into the brain itself. And from there, it sets up a wave pattern, sort of like dropping a pebble in a pond, and the waves move out and reflect off of the shore and back and forth. That reflection inside the skull in the brain itself occurs over a matter of just a few milliseconds, and that's where some of the energy of the blast is transferred that could cause injury.
And that would explain how symptoms from a traumatic brain injury don't show up for weeks or even months. They've also been mapping the brains of GIs back from the war theater who are suffering the effects of TBI to better understand the physiology of the disorder.
What we would also like to do is explore the possibility of maybe studying a higher number of injured veterans. There are many thousands of them. So that we could get even a better understanding of what problems they have, where in the brain those problems are located, get an even better idea of how that correlates with what our modeling studies predict. And that, of course, could then lead to better designs for protective devices.
They expect to openly share their data with the science and design communities to facilitate the creation of better protective gear and better treatment options for those suffering. Studying the precise causes of traumatic brain injury that will lead to better design protective gear to reduce the incidence of such injuries in the future? Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Dan Hawkins, Senior Vice President of Federal, State, and Public Affairs at NAC, the National Association of Community Health Centers, representing the interest of the nation's community health centers, which serve some 20 million Americans at over 8,000 primary care sites around the country. NAC leads legislative advocacy for community health centers on Capitol Hill, organizes grassroots advocacy in local communities, and supports the mission of health centers through technical assistance and research. Dan Hawkins, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you were on the show almost 2 years ago when the Affordable Care Act was just being signed into law. And since that time, the Affordable Care Act has withstood numerous political and legal challenges. It's really a bill that has nine lives. But remind our listeners, Dan, how the Affordable Care Act strengthens and relies on community health centers to further the aims of the act.
Sure. I think the two key factors that I think were most important and the role that health centers played in that were, number one, coverage. We've all understood for years that what every person needs for good health are insurance coverage to make the care that they need affordable to them, and a place that they can go to get that care that is a committed sponsor, really committed to serving that individual with the highest possible quality. Those are the two things we worked on most of all in the Affordable Care Act. First, on coverage, I served on a workhorse group that was appointed by, may he rest in peace, Senator Ted Kennedy, to pull together bipartisan thoughts on health reform. And in that group, I argued for extending Medicaid coverage to everyone up to 200% of the poverty level. Now, I didn't win that argument, but I did get them up from a much lower level that some of the other representatives on that group were pushing for to the 138% level that the Affordable Care Act extends Medicaid coverage to. Of all the different kinds of coverage, private coverage, public coverage out there, Medicaid for the low-income community is the best possible coverage because of the benefits and services that it covers. So that was most important. And then secondly, we argued that once these folks gain coverage, they're going to need a place to go. And again, a place that is a committed sponsor to get them healthy, keep them healthy. And the Affordable Care Act included funds to expand health centers and to expand the National Health Service Corps, all of which would be essential to building care for those newly insured and for the many millions who will remain uninsured even after reform.
Dan, I'm going to ask you a question that's probably challenging to answer in a few minutes, but for the sake of our listeners, so what is a community health center anyway? The origin and history and what makes a primary care organization a community health center? Could you do that for us?
I've always said that community health centers have five basic characteristics, and each comes together to make them a unique kind of healthcare provider that we call community health center. First, every community health center is located in a high-need area. You won't see them in suburbia. You will see them in the inner city. You will see them in rural communities. You'll see them in places where there are significant numbers of low-income folks and folks who have either rely on Medicaid or other kinds of public coverage or are uninsured. Secondly, health centers offer comprehensive health services. It's not just the medical care. There's also, in most health centers, dental care and mental health services, all working together in a team-based atmosphere. There's services that help break down the barriers to care, like outreach and transportation. And then there are services that help make the medical and dental care provided effective, like health education, nutrition education, counseling, and referral. All of those things go together. Number three, and this is, there are relatively few other providers that meet this feature in America today, open to everyone regardless of ability to pay. It doesn't matter if you have gold-plated Cadillac health insurance or no insurance at all. It doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or a pauper. Health centers are open to you. Number four, and this is one of the most unique features, health centers are governed by patient majority community boards. These boards make decisions on things like the hours of operation, the services to be offered, how those without insurance coverage, to what extent, if any, they'll be asked to contribute, what's called the sliding fee scale, et cetera, although care is never denied to anyone for inability to pay. But these community boards make health centers healthcare in the most phenomenal American tradition. Of the people, by the people, for the people. And then finally, health centers are held to strict performance and accountability standards by the federal government, by the board, by the patients, and by themselves. When you consider the entire cost of care for an individual over the course of a year or 2 years or 5 years, that includes emergency room visits, hospitalizations, including visits to the doctor or the dentist or what have you. Studies have shown that the total cost of care for people served at health centers is over $1,200. It's more than $1,200 a year lower for health center patients than it is for those who go to other providers. The record shows that health center patients have fewer hospitalizations, fewer emergency room visits, fewer specialty care referrals because they're kept healthy, and actually fewer diagnostic tests MRIs and CAT scans and the like, and actually lower cost prescription medications, for example, by using generics and making sure that individuals are getting all the medications that they need, but no more. That's why health centers save $24 billion a year today for taxpayers and private payers alike. And when we get to 40 million people in 2015, those savings will rise to $50 billion a year.
Well, Dan, getting to 40 million in 2015 obviously was very much on the minds of our legislators as the Affordable Care Act was crafted. And certainly, I imagine the conversation was in the room was great model, but not enough of them, and where they are, not big enough. And to respond to that, the Affordable Care Act earmarked $11 billion for community health centers to expand their infrastructure. And that infrastructure was both in physical building, but the second was in capacity, which is really about provider staffing and services. How successful has that initiative been? And if you look across the country, what's the progress that's been made in getting ready for that 2015 ramp up, which is really already upon us? It's just a matter of degree.
More than we had expected, but less than we had hoped for. After the act passed in 2010, the first part of that $11 billion in new funding became available, and the federal government invited applications from communities that didn't have a health center today, but needed one. These were so-called new starts, brand new health centers that would be funded for the first time, and also existing health centers that were going to reach out to a community that they weren't able to serve today because they didn't have the resources. More than 1,800 communities came forth and provided applications to expand care at health centers. But then the less than we had hoped kicked in. Congress took back a third of that money in 2011 before it even could be spent. And as a result, only a tiny number, really about 200 of the 1,800 applications, were able to be funded. Now, things get better as long as Congress doesn't tinker with the program anymore, although much has been lost. The worst part is the time that it takes to set up a new health center or a new health center site. It can't be done overnight. And so we've lost, unfortunately, two critically important years of growth as a result of the cutbacks that Congress administered in 2011. And by the way, those cutbacks were not a target aimed at health centers. These were the anti-Obamacare folks who wanted to take back some of the money that Obamacare had provided. But there's still over $2 billion total funding in new funding that will become available and that will become available incrementally in this year and in the next 2 years to expand health centers. And I am confident that if Congress doesn't tinker with that, we will have more than enough communities applying to expand their health centers, and that's going to be the key.
We're speaking today with Dan Hawkins, Senior Vice President of Federal, State, and Public Affairs at NAC, the National Association of Community Health Centers, representing the interest of the nation's community health centers, which serve some 20 million Americans at over 8,000 primary care centers around the country. Dan, I think it's fair to say that Americans have been pining for cooperation and bipartisanship. So I've got two questions. What are the threats that our nation will face and healthcare will face as we look at the fiscal cliff and if we cannot properly address it?
The gravest threat that we face, I think everyone is, well, maybe not everyone, but most are in general agreement that we've got to get our fiscal house in order as a country, as a nation. That means we've got to reduce the deficit. And there's only two ways to do that, to reduce the level of spending or to increase the level of revenues. I think the news over the past week that both sides, both the Democrats and Republicans in Congress and in the White House, have signaled a willingness to come to the table and try to find some common ground gives us great hope. The greatest threat we face, though, is that decisions are made in haste or in broad swath across the board issues. You know, we're on the cusp of the fiscal cliff, the automatic sequester, $1 trillion in spending cuts that would be triggered if Congress is unable to come to some alternative agreement on ways to reduce the deficit. It is an across-the-board cut to defense spending and non-defense spending, to health centers and public education, transportation and other federally supported activities. It's unthinking. It's thoughtless, and that can do great, great harm to the country, whether it's the sequester or if the alternative also includes broad across-the-board cuts without looking carefully at what works and what doesn't. My great hope is that policymakers will be thoughtful as they go through this and will find common ground. We pride ourselves on that bipartisan support and have worked to both keep it and nurture it over the years. And I think we are proof positive that you can do well by doing good.
Dan, during the debates, which now seem like the dim and distant past, but were really only several weeks ago, we heard a lot about Medicaid as an entitlement and an area of significantly increased spending. And certainly, Medicaid is important to low-income people, and it's important to health centers, but it's also very important to our inner-city hospitals, our academic medical centers, what we call the disproportionate share hospitals, those that have a disproportionate share of patients who are uninsured or underinsured. What do you think will happen in this arena now? Can you put on your sort of forecasting hat and answer the question, will political philosophy give way to a pragmatic reality as people try and respond to the needs of their own states?
Well, my response is equal parts hope and practicality, if you will. On the one hand, I can stand back and sit back and say that it was understandable that some of the Republican governors would say no way, no how to the Medicaid expansion before the election. I think the savviest one said, well, we're looking at it carefully and we're going to be hesitant and reluctant and it's going to take a while before we get to a decision. They were keeping their powder dry. I believe, though, that even the hell no Republican governors are now, even at this moment, rethinking their situation. Uncle Sam has said, if you expand Medicaid now, not they can't say you shall expand Medicaid, but the federal government has said, if you expand Medicaid, we will cover 100% of the cost for the first 3 years, and then we will decline over the next 3 years to 90% of the cost, but we will never fall below paying 90% of the cost. I have seen documents that show that for all but literally two or three states, expanding Medicaid will save the state's money out of their own state coffers.
Well, Dan, I think you underscore an important aspect of the Affordable Care Act in terms of how it's focused in on providing access to millions of Americans. But it also is focused in on cultivating new models of care. And there's been growing interest in the accountable care organizations and patient-centered medical homes. Tell us how these models of care build on the successes of community health centers.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One, I love to say that the patient-centered medical home was begun and advanced by a couple of individuals who cut their teeth as clinicians at community health centers. And really, when you look at what the patient-centered medical home is all about, and this is a model where the system of care is totally focused on the individual and on providing them the care they need, not waiting until they get sick to come see the doctor, patch them up, and then send them away again until the next time they're sick, but truly becoming a healthcare system rather than a sickness care system. Now, they need to focus on quality improvement and on patient-centeredness, but I believe that's part and parcel at the core of the health center system. Accountable care organizations takes the concept of patient-centered medical home one giant step further, by moving toward the development of integrated systems of care in which primary care, specialty care, hospital care, even long-term nursing home care and services are all integrated together in a seamless system that focuses on the individual being served, the patient, and their healthcare needs, and ensures that care is coordinated across all of those levels, from primary to specialty to inpatient to long-term care, as needed by the individual. I was pleased, I was out in Texas last month, to learn that already community health centers in Texas have led the formation of two accountable care organizations. And I know in other states, health centers are either joining with or leading the formation of these integrated care delivery systems. I will say that not long after the Affordable Care Act passed, there was, of course, a fury or a flurry of activity around accountable care organizations. ACOs were the hottest topic going, and at that time I said, ACOs are the hula hoop of health reform. They're the big fad here today, gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What I understood clearly even back then is whatever we call them, integrated care is here to stay. And that's where health centers have perhaps the greatest challenge, because for so long we've been out on the front lines in communities with few or no other providers and not well integrated into the healthcare systems in our communities. They literally have to change it by reaching out, forming alliances and partnerships and affiliations and collaborations, and really truly become part of a community's integrated healthcare system.
We've been speaking today with Dan Hawkins, Vice President for Policy at the National Association of Community Health Centers. NAC supports community health centers operating over 8,000 primary care centers in all 50 states and providing healthcare to some 20 million Americans. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
I'm happy to do it.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. These bots are made for walking. Well, maybe not quite the fembots of Austin Powers' world, but scientists at the University of Illinois Urbana have created small bots that walk on their own power. Lead engineering researcher Dr. Rashid Bashir says what they've done is pretty astounding, though deceptively simple. They've created a non-electronic biomedical machine with hydrogel, the flexible material found in contact lenses, printed through a 3D printer with heart cells added on. The small structure is coated with the cells, and then...
And then we feed cardiac cells, these heart cells, from rats. So these are primary cells from rats, and they attach to these structures at the appropriate locations. And then after a few days, when the cells form a confluent sheet, then they start to beat.
Dr. Bashir says once the beating starts, the little bots start moving on their own.
The beating produces a very sort of a quantitative force, which then makes a structure walk or move in a specific direction. So these things walk in a fluid in specific directions as per their design.
So what would this small walking bot be good for? Dr. Bashir and his team see multiple applications. They could be used to test heart drugs, where the velocity of the actual heartbeat can be used as a marker for a drug's efficacy.
So these structures, or structured like this, can be used for rapid drug testing, and this can be an organ mimic.
And there are even broader applications. Sensors on these walking bots could be used to detect toxins in water supplies.
In a water supply where it could be moving around and sensing for specific chemicals or toxin, and then moving towards, let's say, where the source of the toxin is, and then neutralizing it.
And what are you calling these little powerhouses?
So we're calling it a biobot, a biological robot. It's basically, you know, a half a centimeter to a centimeter scale. So it's smaller than the size of, let's say, your thumbnail. And this thing, you know, you can see it actually with naked eye in a petri dish. And this thing moves around and can keep moving for weeks to days, for days to weeks, actually. They have to supply the nutrients, and it has to be in fluid, but it can walk on a surface.
You can see more about the walking biobots, Dr. Bashir's University of Illinois research, in the current issue of the journal Scientific Reports. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.